Today on The Shadow, a former FISA judge says that the NSA's super surveillance regime is unconstitutional. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. A rare public hearing of a mysterious security agency was held this week in Washington, where a former supervising judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court declared that the United States government was acting unconstitutionally in the pro-surveillance star chamber practices of the clandestine court that routinely allows global surveillance of the electronic communications of all American citizens. The agency in question is the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board, or PC Lob, which has maintained neither a website or email nor even an office readily accessible to U.S. citizens. PC Lob was established by President George W. Bush in 2004, but it went for years without any members, prompting a congressional conclusion that, quote, "It appears to be a presidential appendage devoid of the capability to exercise independent judgment and assessment or to provide impartial findings and recommendations on intelligence and constitutional issues," end quote. This week, in one of its rare proofs of life, the panel met for public hearings to minimize the fallout from the revelations of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who revealed ubiquitous monitoring and storage of emails, phone calls, and virtually every type of commercial or electronic record on U.S. citizens. The hearing began with a discussion of the legal issues of contemporary surveillance, where an opening statement was presented by Jamil Jaffer, the Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Thanks for the invitation to participate. Since these programs were disclosed, much of the public debate has focused on issues of policy, and I think that's understandable. No government has ever trained this kind of surveillance power on its own citizens. Until quite recently, none had the technological capacity to do that. We need to think carefully about how the exploitation of new technology could affect liberties that generations of Americans have fought to protect. What I'd like to underscore today is that the recently disclosed surveillance programs aren't just unwise, they're unconstitutional as well. And I'm going to focus principally on the 215 program with the hope that we'll be able to return to 702 later on. Under the 215 program, the NSA collects metadata about every phone call made or received by a resident of the United States. Some news reports indicate that the NSA is collecting internet metadata as well, making a note of every website an American visits and every email he or she receives. The program is a massive dragnet, one that raises many of the concerns associated with general warrants. That is, many of the concerns that led to the adoption of the Fourth Amendment in the first place. You might say that these Section 215 orders are general warrants for a digital age. The President and the DNI have emphasized that the government is collecting metadata, not content. But the suggestion that metadata collection is somehow beyond the reach of the Constitution is wrong. For Fourth Amendment purposes, the crucial question isn't whether the government is collecting metadata or content, but whether it is invading reasonable expectations of privacy. And here it clearly is. The Supreme Court's recent decision in Jones is instructive. In that case, a unanimous court held that long-term surveillance of an individual's location constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment. The justices reached that conclusion for different reasons, but at least five justices were of the view that the surveillance infringed a reasonable expectation of privacy. Justice Sotomayor observed that tracking an individual's movements over an extended period allows the government to generate, quote, "a precise, comprehensive record that reflects a wealth of detail about her familial, political, professional, religious, and sexual associations." The same can be said of the tracking now taking place under Section 215. Call records can reveal personal relationships, medical issues, and political and religious affiliations. Internet metadata may be even more revealing, allowing the government to learn which websites a person visited, precisely which articles she read, whom she corresponds with, and who those people correspond with. The long-term surveillance of metadata constitutes a search for the same reasons that the long-term surveillance of location was found to constitute a search in Jones. In fact, the surveillance that was found unconstitutional in Jones was narrower and shallower than the surveillance now taking place under Section 215. The location tracking in Jones was meant to further a specific criminal investigation into a specific crime, and the government collected information about one person's location over a period of less than a month. What the government has implemented under Section 215 is an indiscriminate program that has already swept up the communications of millions of people over a period of 7 years. Some have argued that Section 215, the program under Section 215, is lawful under Smith v. Maryland, which upheld the installation of a pen register in a criminal investigation. But the pen register in Smith was very primitive. It tracked the numbers being dialed, but it didn't indicate which calls were completed, let alone the duration of the calls. And the surveillance was directed at a single criminal suspect over a period of less than 2 days. The police weren't casting a net over the whole country. Another argument that's been offered in defense of the metadata program is that though the NSA collects an immense amount of information, it examines only a tiny fraction of it. But the Fourth Amendment is triggered by the collection of information, not simply by the querying of it. The same is true of the First Amendment, because the chilling effect of government surveillance stems from the collection of information, not merely the analysis of it. The Constitution isn't indifferent to the government's accumulation of vast quantities of sensitive information about Americans' lives. Neither should the board be. Indeed, it's worth remembering in this context that other countries have aspired to total awareness of their citizens' associations, movements, and beliefs. The experiences of those countries should serve as a caution to us, not as a roadmap. Thank you again for inviting me to participate, and I look forward to the board's questions.
That was the ACLU's Jamil Jaffer. He was followed by former federal district judge James Robertson, who served on the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court between the years 2002 and 2005. Robertson condemned the ex parte procedures of the foreign intelligence courts, saying that, quote, "Anyone who has been a judge will tell you that a judge needs to hear both sides of a case."
Thank you. I should probably first state that I am a member, I am now and have been a member of the Liberty and Security Committee of the Constitution Project, which wrote a report in September of 2012 expressing some alarm about these programs, and I signed that report and stand by it, but that's not primarily what I want to talk about today. I did sit on the FISA court for a few years. I asked to be appointed to the FISA court, frankly, to see what it was up to. And I came away from it deeply impressed by the careful, scrupulous, even fastidious work that the Justice Department people and the NSA FBI agents involved with it did. The FISA court was not a rubber stamp. The numbers that are quoted about how many reports, how many warrants get approved, do not tell you how many were sent back for more work before they were approved. So I know at first hand, and I wish I could assure the American people that the FISA process has integrity, and that the idea of targeting Americans with surveillance is anathema to the judges of the FISA court, which they call the FISC. But I have a couple of related points to make. First, the FISA process is ex parte, which means it's one-sided, and that's not a good thing. And secondly, under the FISA Amendments Act, the FISA court now approves programmatic surveillance. And that I submit and will discuss for a few minutes, I do not consider to be a judicial function. Now, judges are learned in the law and all that. But anybody who has been a judge will tell you that a judge needs to hear both sides of a case before deciding. It's quite common, in fact, it's the norm, to read one side's brief or hear one side's argument and think, that sounds right, until we read the other side. Judging is choosing between adversaries. I read the other day that one of my former FISA court colleagues resisted the suggestion that the FISA approval process accommodated the executive, or maybe the word was cooperated. Not so, the judge replied. The judge said the process was adjudicating. I very respectfully take issue with that use of the word adjudicating. The ex parte FISA process hears only one side, and what the FISA process does is not adjudication, it is approval. Which brings me to my second and I think closely related point. The FISA approval process works just fine when it deals with individual applications for surveillance warrants. Because approving search warrants and wiretap orders and trap and trace orders and foreign intelligence surveillance warrants one at a time is familiar ground for judges. And not only that, but at some point a search warrant or wiretap order, if it leads on to a prosecution or some other consequence, is usually reviewable by another court. But what happened after the revelations in late 2005 about NSA circumventing the FISA process was that Congress passed the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 and introduced a new role for the FISC, which was to approve surveillance programs. That change, in my view, turned the FISA court into something like an administrative agency, which makes and approves rules for others to follow. Again, that's not the bailiwick of judges. Judges don't make policy. They review policy determinations for compliance with statutory law, but they do so in the context, once again, of adversary process. Now, the great paradox of this intelligence surveillance process, of course, is the undeniable need for security. Secrecy, especially to protect what the national security community calls sources and methods. That is why the Supreme Court had to refuse to hear Clapper versus Amnesty International. The plaintiffs could not prove that their communications were likely to be monitored, so they had no standing. That is a classic catch-22 of Supreme Court jurisprudence. But I submit that this process needs an adversary. If it's not the ACLU or Amnesty International, perhaps the PCLOB itself could have some role as a kind of an institutional adversary to challenge and take the other side of anything that is presented to the FISA court. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Judge James Robertson, a veteran of the United States Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The next speaker at the so-called Privacy and Civil Liberties Board hearing was Kenneth Weinstein, a former Bush Homeland Security advisor who attempted to defend the alleged legality of the NSA FISA surveillance regime.
I'd like to focus my remarks today on the FISA Amendments Act and the Section 702 authority that David has described earlier. The recent disclosures regarding the PRISM program have raised questions in some quarters about the appropriateness and legality of the government's collection of international or internet communications traffic, with some expressing surprise that collection of that type and that scale is taking place. A review of the text of the FISA Amendments Act and the historical record reveals, however, that that internet collection appears to be exactly what was contemplated when Congress passed that statute in 2008. I'd like to take a moment to remind ourselves about the FAA, the FISA Amendments Act, and the reason that it came into being in the first place. In 1978, Congress undertook to create a process by which electronic surveillance of foreign powers or their agents must first be approved by the FISA court. In doing so, however, Congress recognized it had to balance the need for a judicial review process for domestic surveillance against the government's need to freely conduct surveillance overseas where constitutional protections do not apply. It sought to accomplish this objective by imposing in the FISA statute a court approval requirement on surveillances directed against persons within the U.S. and leaving the intelligence community free to surveil overseas targets without the undue burden of court process. With the change in technology over the years since FISA was passed, however, that foreign-domestic distinction started to break down. and the government found itself expending significant manpower generating FISA court applications for surveillances against persons outside the United States, the very category of surveillances that Congress specifically intended to exclude when it imposed the FISA court approval process requirement in 1978. As this problem got worse, particularly after the 9/11 attacks, the government found itself increasingly unable to cover its surveillance needs. Congress, to its credit, took up this issue in the spring of 2007, and over the next 15 months or so, numerous government officials, including Steve Bradbury, myself, and others, spent countless hours testifying and meeting with members and staff up on the Hill. And after thorough analysis and deliberations, Congress ultimately provided relief in the form of the FISA Amendments Act, which passed that in the summer of 2008. Section 702 of the FAA created a new process by which categories of foreign surveillance targets can be approved for surveillance. Under this process, the Attorney General and the DNI provide the FISA court annual certifications identifying the target categories and certifying that all statutory requirements for surveillance of those targets have been met. The government in turn designs targeting procedures, which are the operational steps that it takes to determine whether each individual surveillance target is outside the United States, as well as minimization procedures that David described that limit the handling and dissemination of any information relating to U.S. persons. The government then submits the certifications as well as the targeting and minimization procedures for review by the FISA court, and the FISA court confirms whether all statutorily required steps have been taken in compliance with FISA and the Fourth Amendment. Now, this process succeeds in bringing the operation of FISA back in line with its original intent. It still provides that any surveillance targeting a U.S. person here or abroad, or targeting any person believed to be inside the United States, must be conducted pursuant to an individualized FISA court order. However, it allows the government to conduct surveillance of foreign targets overseas without the need to secure individualized court approval. And it does so while at the same time giving the FISA court an important role in ensuring that this authority is used only against those non-U.S. persons who are reasonably believed to be located outside the U.S. In addition, the FAA tasks various levels of government with conducting significant and meaningful oversight over this authority. The authority, procedures, and oversight prescribed by the FAA have been in place since 2008, and just last year they were reauthorized. Prior to this reauthorization, the intelligence committees of both houses were briefed on the classified details of its implementation, and that same briefing was made available to all members. As this history demonstrates, the FAA was a carefully calibrated piece of legislation that addressed an urgent operational need while at the same time maintaining the privacy protections that the original FISA statute afforded to domestic communications. With the recent public disclosures about the PRISM program, we are now seeing the statute in action. Not surprisingly, we are seeing exactly what was contemplated when Congress carefully considered and passed the FAA, which is a program that focuses on the surveillance of foreign national security targets, which is where the executive branch has its greatest latitude, that is conducted well within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment, that is carried out with the knowledge and engagement of all three branches of government, and that is monitored with multiple levels of oversight. And that is exactly what Congress and the American people asked for in the legislative process that resulted in the passage of the FAA. I appreciate the opportunity to address these issues here today and look forward to any questions that the board may have.
However, ACLU Attorney Jaffer was having none of it.
Jamil?
So let me just start by expressing a degree of frustration about something that Mr. Weinstein said. So when we were before the Supreme Court in Amnesty v. Clapper last year, the government repeatedly said, and they said this in the lower courts as well, they repeatedly said that the assertion that the NSA was engaged in large-scale surveillance of Americans' international communications under Section 702 was speculative and even paranoid. And now the program has been disclosed, and everybody can see that the NSA is engaged in exactly that. And the intelligence community, and I would include Mr. Weinstein in that category, intelligence community's position now is that, well, this is what was contemplated by the statute. Everybody knows that this is what the statute was all about. And there's a certain frustration I feel in this sort of moving target. A year ago it was speculative and paranoid, and now there's nothing to see here. And it would trouble me less if it weren't part of a pattern in which executive branch officials and members of the larger intelligence community have repeatedly misled the public about the scope of these surveillance laws and the safeguards that are in place or aren't in place to protect individuals' privacy. And on a related topic, I think it's just very important. Mr. Bradbury points out quite rightly that under 702, the government can target only foreign nationals outside the United States. But nobody should take that to mean that Americans' communications aren't being collected. In the course of collecting the communications of people outside the United States, the NSA collects Americans' communications, and not just their international communications, but their domestic communications as well. That, too, that assertion I just made, was something characterized by the government in Amnesty v. Clapper as speculative and paranoid, but the minimization procedures that have been disclosed over the last few weeks, I think, make clear that that's exactly what's taking place.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and our topic today is an extremely rare public hearing by the so-called Privacy and Civil Liberties Board, which allegedly oversees operations of the NSA and FISC. The hearing also delved into technical issues as well as legal ones when Mark Rotenberg, the executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, dissected the scandalous seizure of Verizon records, pointing out that the so-called metadata is even more revealing than the content of the calls.
I am not now a computer scientist. I was a computer scientist and decided to go to law school to help address the lawyer shortage in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I've contributed my time to solving that problem. In the statement that I've submitted, I outlined some of the steps that EPIC has taken to date and made some recommendations to the Oversight Board. I do want to say that over the years at EPIC, I've had the opportunity to work with many great computer scientists and technical experts. And the one thing that they have taught me is a healthy skepticism of technical solutions to what are ultimately social or policy problems, which is a point that I'll come back to. In brief, let me first describe the steps that we have taken. This may be of interest to the Oversight Board. As many of you know, we filed a mandamus petition with the Supreme Court this week, challenging the legal authority under which the Verizon order was issued by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. This order was based on Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and it requires the telecommunications firm to provide on an ongoing basis all of the call detail records, that's the phrase in the order, as also described as telephone metadata, for all Verizon customers on an ongoing basis. We looked very closely at that statute. We read an enormous amount of commentary. We simply concluded that the court did not have the legal authority to issue that order. We believe that the Supreme Court was the only court that we could bring this claim to, and that's a very important part of the analysis, I think. Even as we talk about changes in the law, we have to answer the question, under current law, is this surveillance activity lawful? The second thing that EPIC has done is to begin the formal petition process to the NSA director, General Alexander. The National Security Agency, like all federal agencies, is subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. And when it engages in a substantial change in agency practice, it actually has an obligation to notify the public of its determination. Now, of course, there are certain rules, almost unique rules, that apply to the NSA, and we understand that. But that doesn't get the agency out from under its fundamental responsibility to be accountable to the public. And as we did with the Department of Homeland Security when they made the decision to deploy the airport body scanners for primary screening, and that challenge was ultimately successful in the D.C. Circuit, we think on a similar basis, the National Security Agency should give the public the opportunity to comment on this domestic surveillance program. We have also asked the Federal Communications Commission to determine whether Verizon may have violated Section 222 of the Communications Act when it turned over the customer records to the National Security Agency. The FCC plays a critical role in safeguarding the privacy interests of American telephone consumers. And finally, we've pursued a series of Freedom of Information Act requests for some of the key legal documents that have been thus far kept secret. If you have suggestions for more things that we should be doing, please send email, mark@epic.org. We're very interested. In brief, let me summarize the key points of my written statement. The first point that I'd like to make, as I did already, is that we think the legal authority was exceeded in the Section 215 activity. It's set out in the petition in considerable detail, summarized in our statement. The second point as to metadata is that this information is far more detailed and far more revealing of personal activity than typically the underlying content in a communication. And in this sense, current law, U.S. law in particular, is almost upside down with respect to the privacy interest. As many of you know, our laws have evolved following a paradigm which basically distinguishes between the content of a message, what's in the envelope, and the header information contained on the exterior of the envelope, and we've carried that forward with the contents of a telephone communication as opposed to the CPNI, the call detail information. But that analysis, you know, which might have worked 40 years ago when Smith versus Maryland was decided, is almost unrelated to current circumstance. Because in a digital world, as opposed to an analog world, it's the digital data, it's the transactional data that enables the linking, the chaining, the profiling, the matching, the assessing, the ranking, the rating, all the analytic techniques that are deployed to assess personal information are most useful as against transactional data. Underlying communications actually requires interpretation and assessment, and it's a slower process. So the second point is that the metadata, which has been said as something of less privacy interest than the content, in fact, the opposite is true. And I think that is the view widely held in the scientific community. The third point to make is that this type of data, unlike underlying content, generates additional uses. I've said in the past that data chases applications, which is to say that once you have information collected and stored in a database, you will not surprisingly find new uses for it. In fact, it would be surprising if you didn't find new uses. Now, you can, through law, attempt to restrict and legislate the way in which the data that you've collected may be used. But over time, almost certainly, those boundary points will be pushed further and further as more applications for the data are found. And I think the conclusion to draw from this point is that a threshold is crossed once the data is gathered, because it is at that moment that you've created the opportunity for future applications. Whether you choose at that moment in time to permit those applications is a safeguard you can put in place, but there is no guarantee that that safeguard will remain over time. The final point that I'll make, coming back to my original comment, is that it's very tempting to imagine that there are technological solutions to privacy problems. And I will say our organization, EPIC, has been on the front line since our founding to promote technologies to protect privacy. We were started over the freedom to use encryption. We've supported de-identification, anonymization, techniques of minimization. All of these methods are very important. But there is no question that at the end of the day, the most effective safeguards are the legal safeguards. And I just wanted to close by sharing with you a quote from President Jerome Wiesner, former president of MIT. He was the first science advisor to President Kennedy. He was asked to testify before the U.S. Congress in the early days of the hearings on the Privacy Act. And he was asked this question, are there technological solutions to the problem of privacy? And he said, there are those who hope new technology can redress these invasions of privacy that information technology now makes possible. But I don't share this hope. To be sure, it is possible and desirable to provide technical safeguards against unauthorized access. It is even conceivable that computers could be programmed. This is 40 years ago, by the way. It is even conceivable that computers could be programmed to have their memories fade with time and to eliminate specific identity. Such safeguards are highly desirable, but the basic safeguards cannot be provided by new inventions. They must be provided by the legislative and legal systems of this country. We must face the need to provide adequate guarantees for individual privacy. Thank you.
Private researcher Ashkan Zoltani further emphasized the point that in today's global environment, there is no such thing as a national border, thereby undermining the prime excuse for allowing the NSA's surveillance overreach.
Ashkan.
Great. Thanks for having me. And I want to just echo, before I start, just echo Mark's points that I agree that wholeheartedly that the metadata is actually more sensitive in times than the content. And the retention of this information exposes, even with policy safeguards, just the existence of this information collected at points that normally wouldn't be collected, exposes us to great risk from breach, from misuse, similar to the ways where hanging a piano over my head might be legal, but it exposes me to being crushed by that piano at some point. So I'm going to talk today about just kind of four points, I've written these in draft comments on my blog, which you guys can refer to, and I'll submit them by the first. I'm expecting that there's probably more revelations that are going to be made, and I'd like to incorporate those before I submit. So the points I want to make is, one, that traditional ideas about geography and borders don't really translate onto the internet. And that, two, that most of our modern activities take place in part through some digital medium. They create data trails about our activities. In fact, the NSA itself remarked that in 2002, they remarked that only 1% of the 290 gigabytes of internet traffic at the time was outside of their reach at the time. That's in 2002, right? And two other points: that the computer systems don't inherently understand law. They don't understand borders. They don't, you know, they don't have the same kind of limitations that we do, or understanding that we do, and that they work under the guidance of their operators. And these operators are empowered under a legal authority, which I feel like might be confused or lack understanding of the technical capabilities, right? One is, for example, the point Mark made, that the metadata has more capabilities, or big data has more capabilities than we would naturally logically infer, but just other understandings of how the technology operates. And so I'd like to expand on that a bit. And then one other point of clarification from this morning's kind of discussion was that there's been a couple different kind of very clever pushbacks and a couple different revelations we've made, but the metadata collection wasn't just business records. It wasn't just the NSA going to AT&T and saying, show us our call records from that you collected historically. There was, at multiple times, equipment that the NSA had implanted at key internet exchanges and key junctions at service providers in order to themselves create this metadata and collect it. And we want to be mindful of that particular hook, because it's a very different issue than just going to Verizon and saying, hey, give us call records. This is generating call records, generating IP metadata, and the process by which that's generated is problematic because, as I said, computers don't understand law. They don't understand the difference between, say, they do understand the difference, but it's very small distinction between an IP header and the email content itself, right? And the same equipment is often very easily able to capture that same data if it wanted to, and we have some understanding that they were actually collecting email content from the wire. So I'm going to start just to expand on the first point, which is on a quote that former NSA Director Hayden himself made in an interview recently, where he said, let's keep in mind that global telecom infrastructure, geography doesn't mean what it used to be. Things of a place may not be in a place, and things in a place may not be of a place. The internet actually lacks geography. And so this is his statement it's kind of telling, the person who kind of spearheaded these projects himself doesn't believe that there's an inherent geography to the internet. And we kind of need to push on this a bit, because in fact we want to understand that the NSA is collecting information about kind of any geography and then using or taking technical measures to limit the amount of information they use on Americans. And to do this, it's kind of unreliable. I describe a couple ways where this breaks down in my comments around things like users using VPNs, users switching email addresses, users, for example, the NSA maintains a database of identifiers on US citizens, which in itself is information about Americans, not anonymous information, but for example, phone numbers, MAC addresses, internet IP addresses, this kind of thing, to identify who's an American. American, right? And so that's actually information about Americans. And oftentimes these things can, to the degree that they're right, they're problematic, and to the degree that they're wrong, oftentimes it's problematic because they'll be inadvertently collecting information. The other thing that kind of complicates things is that the systems that are in place, you know, using these identifiers, using these selectors, right, to discern content, can often be implemented improperly, right? So in fact, we know that through contact chaining, targets of interest could be anyone that has affiliation or interactions with someone else of interest, right? So I could potentially be a target of interest by my communication with someone of interest. But you'll find that most of the modern internet systems that we use today, things like Skype, P2P apps like Skype or Spotify. I don't know if you guys use Spotify to listen to music. These are P2P apps, right? They connect with anyone on the internet for the purpose of providing the service, right? Like, so if I and a member of Al-Qaeda like the same Britney Spears song, right, does that actually put me as a target, right? Does that put me as a target under this contact chaining? And so the system would probably say yes, because I have, you know, some sort of communication with that target, some sort of data sharing with that target. But we want to be mindful that these systems are limited in the way they understand geography. And then finally, I want to make the point, and I make this in my comments as well, that I feel like most of the, you know, we might look to Congress and look at policymakers at why, you know, they've had repeated opportunities to kind of shut down and push back on these programs, and they haven't. And we might infer that to mean that they think these programs are justified, or think that they are effective, or they're worth the trade-off. But one other explanation I want to propose is that, again, people don't understand the technical implications and the raw elements that go into these systems, right? So that, in fact, the policymakers don't actually understand the technical capabilities of these underlying infrastructures and what data they ingest and what they're capable of. And because of that lack of understanding, that it seems generally okay, right? The geeks have the key to the castle, where they'll give you an explanation that, of course, the system will collect information, but in fact, if you looked under the hood, you'd realize that there is actually quite a bit of domestic surveillance going on, quite a lot of inadvertent data collected, quite a lot of misuse from both a policy and a technical perspective. And I think that lack of understanding might explain why there hasn't been kind of tighter controls.
The so-called Privacy and Civil Liberties Board hearing concluded with confusion among its figureheads, who seemed perplexed about separating American citizens from foreign fair game for surveillance and espionage.
We have a law, 702, which is based upon the geography of people, persons. And let's assume for now that persons means an individual. So an individual only exists in one place at a time. And we have a system that is based upon assessing where that individual is, and if they are outside the United States and not believed to be a U.S. person, then they can be subject to collection under 702. Now, my question is, what are the best and what are the worst indicators of whether a person is outside the United States? Steve?
So there are several technologies that are commonly used. The most common one is something called IP geolocation. There are databases saying where different IP addresses are, internet protocol addresses, and you can look at this. This is used by gambling sites, by Major League Baseball, to see if you're in the blackout area and so on.
And by the way, don't forget the possibility of non-technological means determining where a person is.
It's an imperfect technology. It's probably about 85% accurate, more accurate when you talk about the country level rather than the city level.
Which one are you talking about now?
This IP geolocation. Okay. The NSA actually has a patent on a somewhat more advanced technique, which uses round trip time from geographically known points. Speed of light is a limit. I don't know if they're actually using it, but there's a U.S. patent that they were granted on this. The problem that data doesn't respect national boundaries, and as we see more and more data moving to the quote cloud unquote, and if you're operating one of these large data warehouses in the internet someplace. You want it dispersed geographically for reliability, redundancy. Another Northeast blackout, another California blackout won't take it out. A lot of the migration is going to happen quite transparently, and nobody is controlling where a lot of this stuff goes. So geography of the data makes for a very, very poor analog.
But again, we have a law here. We have a law here that ignores the geography of the data and focuses on the geography of the person. And I'm trying to ask. Ashkan, finish up, Steve, and then go to Ashkan.
There are approaches. They're not perfect, especially a lot of the technical mechanisms that business travelers especially use when they're traveling. Virtual private networks makes them appear in the U.S. or not in the U.S., depending what their country origin is. It's not a particularly useful paradigm today, and there's a lot of stuff that's out there which is not easily attributable to a particular person because of Twitter handles, and the solution of massive databases has its own privacy risks.
Ashkan, and then I'll go back to Mark.
But I want to echo Steve's comment. There's actually the third largest ISP in New Zealand has a they have a feature where their IP addresses become borderless. They can appear to come from the UK or come to the US, so they can have access to things like Hulu or BBC, right? So these are like commonly VPN tools are commonly used, and they basically render IP-based geolocation somewhat ineffective. IP geolocation will tell you the source of the network equipment, but it won't tell you the location of the individual. But one thing I want to point out is email addresses don't have the same property, right? So an email address doesn't inherently have a nationality that you can infer from the email address, right? So perhaps you can look at the country code or maybe the nationality of the name, but there's nothing actually inherent to the email address. And in fact, we've learned that most email between cloud providers, right? So when you go to Gmail and you send an email, even though you see a lock icon in your browser, when Gmail delivers that email to someone else, it's transmitted through Gmail servers in the cloud, as Steve described, in clear text, right? And so anyone with equipment at large internet exchanges can monitor that and scoop that information up, metadata or content. And the question is, at what point then, or how do they determine whether it's it's a US citizen or not? And so, and we understand that there's some indication to show that they have databases of US citizens, but there's other indication to show that there is other data appended to it to infer, right? And at that point, you're actually looking at the data. If 702 is a collection limit, you've collected and looked and processed the data, at which point then you decide, well, it might be American, right? The problem with that is it's kind of after the fact, right? You've already looked and processed the data. And then we know under Section 5, that if you actually encounter any illegal activity in that process, you're then able to hand it over to other law enforcement agencies for processing, right, under 6572. So it renders this problem of email identity somewhat borderless and somewhat ineffective to try to differentiate.
Can I just
I'm going to go to Mark next, Danny, and then I'll go to you. Mark was next.
Let me see if I can give you a somewhat more precise answer, shaking the cobwebs of my computer science background. Now, for locating the device, typical cell phone can be located based on three techniques. One is the cell service triangulation. The second is the GPS, which the devices typically include, and the third is the Wi-Fi access to the local router. But you're talking about the identity of the individual. You're actually talking about the individual using the device at a moment in time. And that's actually a problem in isomorphic mapping. In other words, you need a big table of all US citizens, and then you need a unique link to the user of that device at that moment in time. Because, by the way, the person who's holding John Smith's device may not necessarily be John Smith.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we've been listening to proceedings of this week's rare public hearing of the so-called Privacy and Civil Liberties Board.
Selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row. Cinderella, she seems so easy. It takes one to know one. She smiles and puts her hands in her back pocket, Betty Davis style. And in comes Romeo, he's moaning, "You belong to me, I believe." And someone says, "You're in the wrong place, my friend. You'd better leave." And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go is Cinderella sweeping up on Desolation Road. Now the moon is almost hidden. The stars are beginning to hide. The fortune-telling lady has even taken all her things inside. All except for Cain and Abel and the hunchback of Notre Dame. Everybody is making love or else expecting rain. And the good Samaritan, he's dressing, he's getting ready for the show. He's going to the carnival tonight on Desolation Row. Ophelia, she's neath the window. For her I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid. Her death is quite romantic. She wears an iron vest. Her profession's her religion. Her sin is her lifelessness. And though her eyes are fixed upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into Desolation Row. Einstein disguised as Robin Hood with his memories in a trunk passed this way an hour ago with his friend, a jealous monk. Now he looked so immaculately frightful as he bummed a cigarette. Then he went off sniffing drain pipes and reciting the alphabet. You would not think to look at him, but he was famous long ago. Dr. Filth, he keeps his world inside of a leather cup, but all his sexless patients, they are trying to blow it up. Now his nurse, some local loser, she's in charge of the cyanide hole, and she also keeps the cards that read, "Have mercy on his soul." They all play on the penny whistle. You isolation room. Across the street, they've nailed the curtains. They're getting ready for the feast. The Phantom of the Opera in a perfect image of a priest. Here a spoon-feeding Casanova to get him to feel more assured. Then they'll kill him with self-confidence after poisoning him with words. And the Phantom shouting to skinny girls, get out of here if you don't know. Casanova is just being punished for going to Desolation Row. At midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew come out and round up everyone that knows more than they do. Then they bring them to the factory where the heart attack machine is strapped across their shoulders. And then the kerosene is brought down from the castles by insurance men who go check to see that nobody is escaping to Desolation Row. Praise be to Nero's Neptune. The Titanic sails at dawn. Everybody's shouting, which side are you on? And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower, while Calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers. Between the windows of the sea, where lovely mermaids flow, and nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row. Yesterday, about the time the dawn I broke, when you asked me how I was doing, was that some kind of joke? All these people that you mentioned, yes, I know them, they're quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name. Right now, I can't read too good. Don't send me no more letters, no. Not unless you mail them from Desolation Row.
And that concludes today's 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Sean Rhodes. We welcome your comments, questions, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.